the oily feel to the air. The metal girders seemed to be coated in oil, but when Norman touched them, the oil didn't come off on his fingers. He realized that the metal itself had an unusual texture. It was slick and slightly soft to the touch, almost rubbery. "Interesting," Ted said. "Some kind of new material. We associate strength with hardness, but this metal, if it is metal, is both strong and soft. Materials technology is obviously advanced since our day."
"Obviously," Harry said.
"Well, it makes sense," Ted said. "If you think of America 50 years ago as compared with today, one of the biggest changes is the great variety of plastics and ceramics we have now that were not even imagined back then." Ted continued to talk, his voice echoing in the cavernous darkness. But Norman could hear the tension in his voice. Ted's whistling in the dark, he thought. They moved deeper into the ship. Norman felt dizzy to be so high in the gloom. They came to a branch point in the catwalk. It was hard to see with all the pipes and struts, like being in a forest of metal.
"Which way?"
Barnes had a wrist compass. It glowed green. "Go right." They followed the network of catwalks for 10 minutes more. Gradually, Norman could see that Barnes was right. There was a central cylinder constructed within the outer cylinder and held away from it by a dense arrangement of girders and supports. A spacecraft within a spacecraft. Why would they build the ship like this?
You'd have to ask them.
The reasons must have been compelling, Barnes said. The power requirements for a double hull with so much lead shielding. Hard to imagine the engine you'd need to make something this big fly. After 3 or 4 minutes, they arrived at the door on the inner hull. It looked like the outer door.
Breathers back on?
I don't know. Can we risk it?
Without waiting, Beth flipped up the panel of buttons, pressed open, and the door rumbled open. More darkness beyond.
They stepped through. Norman felt softness underfoot. He shined his light down on beige carpeting. Their flashlights crisscrossed the room, revealing a large, contoured beige console with 3 high-backed padded seats. The room was clearly built for human beings.
Must be the bridge or the cockpit.
But the curved consoles were completely blank. There was no instrumentation of any kind, and the seats were empty. They swung their beams back and forth in the darkness.
Looks like a mock-up rather than the real thing.
It can't be a mock-up.
Well, it looks like one.
Norman ran his hand over the smooth contours of the console. It was nicely molded, pleasant to feel. Norman pressed the surface, felt it bend to his touch, rubbery again. Another new material. Norman's flashlight showed a few artifacts. Taped to the far end of the console was a hand-marked sign on a 3x5 filing card. It said, "Go, baby, go." Nearby was a small plastic statuette of a cute animal that looked like a purple squirrel. The base said, "Lucky Lemontina," whatever that meant.
"These seats leather?"
"Looks like it. Where are the damned controls?" Norman continued to poke at the blank console. And suddenly the beige console surface took on depth and appeared to contain instruments, screens. All the instrumentation was somehow within the surface of the console, like an optical illusion or a hologram. Norman read the lettering above the instruments. Pause thrusters, F3 piston booster, glider, sieves.
"More new technology," Ted said. "Reminiscent of liquid crystals, but far superior. Some kind of advanced optoelectronics."
Suddenly, all the console screens glowed red, and there was a beeping sound. Startled, Norman jumped back. The control panel was coming to life. "Watch it, everybody." A single, bright, lightning flash of intense white light filled the room, leaving a harsh afterimage.
"Oh, God."
Another flash, and another. And then the ceiling lights came on, evenly illuminating the room. Norman saw startled, frightened faces. He sighed, exhaling slowly.
"Jesus."
"How the hell did that happen?" Barnes said.
"It was me," Beth said. "I pushed this button."
Let's not go around pushing buttons, if you don't mind, Barnes said irritably.
It was marked room lights. It seemed an appropriate thing to do.
Let's try to stay together on this, Barnes said.
Well, Jesus, Hal.
Just don't push any more buttons, Beth.
They were moving around the cabin, looking at the instrument panel, at the chairs. All of them, that is, all except for Harry. He stood very still in the middle of the room, not moving, and said,
Anybody see a date anywhere?
No date.
There's got to be a date, Harry said, suddenly tense. And we've got to find it, because this is definitely an American spaceship from the future.
What's it doing here? Norman asked.
Damned if I know, Harry said. He shrugged.
Norman frowned. What's wrong, Harry?
Nothing.
Sure?
Yeah, sure.
Norman thought, he's figured out something, and it bothers him, but he's not saying what it is.
Ted said, So this is what a time travel machine looks like.
I don't know, Barnes said. If you ask me, this instrument panel looks like it's for flying, and this room looks like a flight deck.
Norman thought so, too. Everything about the room reminded him of an airplane cockpit. The three chairs for pilot, co-pilot, navigator. The layout of the instrumentation.
This was a machine that flew, he was sure of it. Yet, something was odd. He slipped into one of the contoured chairs. The soft, leather-like material was almost too comfortable. He heard a gurgling. Water inside?
I hope you're not going to fly this sucker, Ted laughed.
No, no.
What's that whirring noise?
The chair gripped him. Norman had an instant of panic, feeling the chair move all around his body, squeezing his shoulders, wrapping around his hips. The leather padding slid around his head, covering his ears, drawing down over his forehead. He was sinking deeper, disappearing inside the chair itself, being swallowed up by it.
Oh, God.
And then the chair snapped forward, pulling up tight before the control console. And the whirring stopped.
Then, nothing.
I think, Beth said, that the chair thinks you are going to fly it.
Norman said, trying to control his breathing, his racing pulse.
I wonder how I get out.
The only part of his body still free were his hands. He moved his fingers, felt a panel of buttons on the arms of the chair. He pressed one. The chair slid back, opened like a soft clam, released him.
Norman climbed out and looked back at the imprint of his body, slowly disappearing, as the chair whirred and adjusted itself.
Harry poked one of the leather pads experimentally, heard the gurgle.
Water filled.
Makes perfect sense, Barnes said. Water's not compressible. You can withstand enormous G-forces sitting in a chair like this.
And the ship itself is built to take great strains, Ted said.
Maybe time travel is strenuous?
Structurally strenuous?
Maybe. Norman was doubtful.
But I think Barnes is right. This is a machine that flew.
Perhaps it just looks that way, Ted said.
After all, we know how to travel in space, but we don't know how to travel in time. We know that space and time are really aspects of the same thing, space-time.
Perhaps you're required to fly in time just the way you fly in space.
Maybe time travel and space travel are more similar than we think now.
Aren't we forgetting something? Beth said. Where is everybody?
If people flew this thing in either time or space, where are they?
Probably somewhere else on the ship.
I'm not so sure, Harry said. Look at this leather on these seats. It's brand new.
Maybe it was a new ship.
No, I mean really brand new. This leather doesn't show any scratches, any cuts, any coffee cup spills or stains. There is nothing to suggest that these seats have ever been sat in.
Maybe there wasn't any crew.
Why would you have seats if there wasn't any crew?
Maybe they took the crew out at the last minute. It seems they were worried about radiation. The inner hull's lead-shielded, too.
Why should there be radiation associated with time travel?
I know, Ted said. Maybe the ship got launched by accident. Maybe the ship was on the launch pad and somebody pressed the button before the crew got aboard so the ship took off empty.
You mean, oops, wrong button?
That'll be a hell of a mistake, Norman said. Barnes shook his head. I'm not buying it. For one thing, a ship this big could never be launched from Earth. It had to be built and assembled in orbit and launched from space.
What do you make of this? Beth said, pointing to another console near the rear of the flight deck. There was a fourth chair, drawn up close to the console. The leather was wrapped around a human form.
No kidding.
There's a man in there?
Let's have a look. Beth pushed the armrest buttons. The chair whirred back from the console and unwrapped itself. They saw a man staring forward, his eyes open.
My God! After all these years, perfectly preserved, Ted said.
You would expect that, Harry said, considering he's a mannequin.
But he's so lifelike.
Give our descendants some credit for advances, Harry said. They're half a century ahead of us. He pushed the mannequin forward, exposing an umbilicus running out the back at the base of the hips.
Wires. Not wires, Ted said. Glass. Optical cables. This whole ship uses optical technology and not electronics.
In any case, it's one mystery solved, Harry said, looking at the dummy. Obviously, this craft was built to be a manned ship, but it was sent out unmanned.
Why?
Probably the intended voyage was too dangerous. They sent an unmanned vessel first before they sent a manned vessel.
Beth said, and where did they send it?
With time travel, you don't send it to a where, you send it to a when.
Okay, then to when did they send it?
Harry shrugged.
No information yet, he said. That diffidence again, Norman thought.
What was Harry really thinking?
Well, this craft is half a mile long, Barnes said. We have a lot more to see.
I wonder if they had a flight recorder, Norman said.
You mean like a commercial airliner?
Yes, yeah, something to record the activity of the ship on its voyage.
They must have, Harry said. Trace the dummy cable back, you're sure to find it.
I'd like to see that recorder, too. In fact, I would say it is crucial.
Norman was looking at the console, lifting up a keyboard panel. Look here, he said. I found a date. They clustered around. There was a stamp in the plastic beneath the keyboard. Intel Inc., made in USA. Serial number 98004077-8543. August 5th, 2043?
Looks like it.
So we're walking through a ship 50-odd years before it's going to be built.
This is giving me a headache.
Look here.
Beth had moved forward from the console deck into what looked like living quarters. There were 20 bunk beds.
Crew of 20?
If it took 3 people to fly it, what were the other 17 for?
Nobody had an answer to that.
Next, they entered a large kitchen, a toilet, living quarters. Everything was new and sleekly designed, but recognizable for what it was.
You know, Hal, this is a lot more comfortable than DH-8.
Yes, maybe we should move in here.
Absolutely not, Barnes said. We're studying this ship, not living in it. We've got a lot more work to do before we even begin to know what this is all about.
It'd be more efficient to live here while we explore it.
I don't want to live here, Harry said. It gives me the creeps.
Me too, Beth said. They had been aboard the ship for an hour now, and Norman's feet hurt. That was another thing he hadn't anticipated. While exploring a large spacecraft from the future, your feet could begin to hurt. But Barnes continued on. Leaving the crew quarters, they entered a vast area of narrow walkways set out between great sealed compartments that stretched ahead as far as they could see. The compartments turned out to be storage bays of immense size. They opened one bay and found it was filled with heavy plastic containers, which looked rather like the loading containers of contemporary airliners, except many times larger. They opened one container.
No kidding, Barnes said, peering inside. What is it?
Food.
The food was wrapped in layers of lead foil and plastic, like NASA rations. Ted picked one up.
Food from the future, he said, and smacked his lips.
You going to eat that? Harry said.
Absolutely, Ted said.
You know, I once had a bottle of Dom Perignon 1897. But this will be the first time I've ever had anything to eat from the future, from 2043.
It's also 300 years old, Harry said.
Maybe you'll want to film this, Ted said to Edmonds. Me eating.
Edmonds dutifully put the camera to her eye, flicked on the light.
Let's not do that now, Barnes said. We have other things to accomplish.
This is human interest, Ted said.
Not now, Barnes said firmly.
He opened a second storage container, and a third. They all contained food. They moved to the next storage bay and opened more containers.
It's all food, nothing but food.
The ship had traveled with an enormous amount of food. Even allowing for a crew of 20, it was enough food for a voyage of several years. They were getting very tired. It was a relief when Beth found a button, said, I wonder what this does.
Barnes said, Beth.
And the walkway began to move, rubber tread rolling forward with a slight hum.
Beth, I want you to stop pushing every damn button you see.
But nobody else objected. It was a relief to ride the walkway past dozens of identical storage bays. Finally, they came to a new section, much farther forward. Norman guessed by now they were a quarter of a mile from the crew compartment in the back. That meant they were roughly in the middle of the huge ship. And here they found a room with life support equipment and 20 hanging spacesuits.
Bingo, Ted said. It's finally clear. This ship is intended to travel to the stars.
The others murmured, excited by the possibility. Suddenly, it all made sense. The great size, the vastness of the ship, the complexity of the control consoles.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Harry said. It can't have been made to travel to the stars. This is obviously a conventional spacecraft, although very large. And at conventional speeds, the nearest star is 250 years away.
Maybe they had new technology.
Where is it? There's no evidence of new technology.
Well, maybe it's...
Face the facts, Ted, Harry said. Even with this huge size, the ship is only provisioned for a few years, 15 or 20 years at most. How far could it go in that time? Barely out of the solar system, right?
Ted nodded dumbly.
It's true. It took the Voyager spacecraft 5 years to reach Jupiter, 9 years to reach Uranus, and 15 years. Maybe they were going to Pluto.
Why would anyone want to go to Pluto?
We don't know yet, but...
The radios squawked. The voice of Tina Chan said, Captain Barnes, surface wants you for a secure encrypted communication, sir.
Okay, Barnes said. It's time to go back anyway.
They headed back, through the vast ship, to the main entrance. Space and time. They were sitting in the lounge of DH-8, watching the divers work on the grid. Barnes was in the next cylinder, talking to the surface. Levy was cooking lunch, or dinner, a meal anyway. They were all getting confused about what the Navy people called surface time.
Surface time doesn't matter down here, Edmund said in her precise librarian's voice. Day or night, it just doesn't make any difference. You get used to it.
They nodded vaguely. Everyone was tired, Norman saw. The strain, the tension of the exploration, had taken its toll. Beth had already drifted off to sleep, feet up on the coffee table, her muscular arms folded across her chest. Outside the window, three small submarines had come down and were hovering over the grid. Several divers were clustered around. Others were heading back to the divers' habitat, DH-7.
Looks like something's up, Harry said.
Something to do with Barnes's call?
Could be.
Harry was still preoccupied, distracted.
Where's Tina Chan?
She must be with Barnes. Why?
I need to talk to her.
What about? Ted said.
It's personal, Harry said. Ted raised his eyebrows, but said nothing more. Harry left, going into D-Sill. Norman and Ted were alone.
"He's a strange fellow," Ted said.
"Is he?"
"You know he is, Norman. Arrogant, too.
Probably because he's black. Compensating, don't you think?"
"I don't know."
"I'd say he has a chip on his shoulder," Ted said. "He seems to resent everything about this expedition."
He sighed.
"Of course, mathematicians are all strange. He's probably got no sort of life at all. I mean, a private life, women and so forth. Did I tell you I married again?"
"I read it somewhere," Norman said.
"She's a television reporter," Ted said.
"Wonderful woman."
He smiled. "When we got married, she gave me this Corvette. Beautiful 58 Corvette as a wedding present. You know that nice fire engine red color they had in the 50s? That color."
Ted paced around the room, glanced over at Beth. "I just think this is all unbelievably exciting. I couldn't possibly sleep."
Norman nodded. It was interesting how different they all were, he thought. Ted, eternally optimistic, with the bubbling enthusiasm of a child. Harry, with the cold, critical demeanor, the icy mind, the unblinking eye. Beth, not so intellectual or so cerebral, at once more physical and more emotional. That was why, though they were all exhausted, only Beth could sleep.
"Say, Norman," Ted said, "I thought you said this was going to be scary."
"I thought it would be," Norman said.
"Well," Ted said, "of all the people who could be wrong about this expedition, I'm glad it was you."
"I am too.
Although I can't imagine why you would select a man like Harry Adams for this team. Not that he isn't distinguished, but..."
Norman didn't want to talk about Harry.
"Ted, remember back on the ship when you said space and time are aspects of the same thing?"
"Space-time, yes."
"I've never really understood that."
"Why? It's quite straightforward."
"You can explain it to me?"
"Sure."
"In English?" Norman said.
"You mean explain it without mathematics?"
"Yes."
"Well, I'll try." Ted frowned, but Norman knew he was pleased. Ted loved to lecture. He paused for a moment, then said, "Okay, let's see where we need to begin. You're familiar with the idea that gravity is just geometry?"
"No."
"Curvature of space and time?"
"Not really, no."
Einstein's general relativity?"
"Sorry," Norman said.
"Never mind," Ted said. There was a bowl of fruit on the table. Ted emptied the bowl, setting the fruit on the table. "Okay, this table is space. Nice, flat space."
"Okay," Norman said.
Ted began to position the pieces of fruit. "This orange is the sun. And these are the planets which move in circles around the sun. So we have the solar system on this table."
"Okay."
"Fine," Ted said. "Now, the sun," he pointed to the orange in the center of the table, "is very large, so it has a lot of gravity."
"Right."
Ted gave Norman a ball bearing. "This is a spaceship. I want you to send it through the solar system so it passes very close to the sun, okay?" Norman took the ball bearing and rolled it so it passed close to the orange.
"Okay."
"You notice that your ball rolled straight across the flat table."
"Right.
But in real life, what would happen to your spacecraft when it passed near the sun?"
"It would get sucked into the sun."
"Yes."
"We say it would fall into the sun. The spacecraft would curve inward from a straight line and hit the sun. But your spacecraft didn't."
"No."
"So we know that the flat table is wrong," Ted said. "Real space can't be flat like the table."
"It can't?"
"No," Ted said. He took the empty bowl and set the orange in the bottom. "Now, roll your ball straight across, past the sun." Norman flicked the ball bearing into the bowl. The ball curved and spiraled down the inside of the bowl until it hit the orange.
"Okay," Ted said. "The spacecraft hit the sun just like it would in real life."
"But if I gave it enough speed," Norman said, "it'd go right past it. It'd roll down and up the far side of the bowl and out again."
"Correct,"
Ted said. "Also like real life. If the spacecraft has enough velocity,
it will escape the gravitational field of the sun.
Right.
So, Ted said, what we are showing is that a spacecraft passing the sun in real life behaves as if it were entering a curved region of space around the sun. Space around the sun is curved like this bowl.
Okay.
And if your ball had the right speed, it wouldn't escape from the bowl, but instead would just spiral around endlessly inside the rim of the bowl. And that's what the planets are doing. They are endlessly spiraling inside the bowl created by the sun.
He put the orange back on the table.
In reality, you should imagine the table is made out of rubber, and the planets are all making dents in the rubber as they sit there. That's what space is really like. Real space is curved, and the curvature changes with the amount of gravity.
Yes.
So, Ted said, space is curved by gravity.
Okay.
And that means that you can think of gravity as nothing more than the curvature of space. The Earth has gravity because the Earth curves the space around it.
Okay.
Except, it's not that simple, Ted said.
Norman sighed. I didn't think it would be.
Harry came back into the room, looked at the fruit on the table, but said nothing.
Now, Ted said, when you roll your ball bearing across the bowl, you notice that it not only spirals down, but it also goes faster, right?
Yes.
Now, when an object goes faster, time on that object passes slower.
Einstein proved that early in the century.
What it means is that you can think of the curvature of space as also representing a curvature of time. The deeper the curve in the bowl, the slower time passes.
Harry said, well, layman's terms, Ted said, give the guy a break.
Yeah, Norman said, give the guy a break.
Ted held up the bowl.
Now, if you're doing all this mathematically, what you find is that the curved bowl is neither space nor time, but the combination of both, which is called space-time. This bowl is space-time, and objects moving on it are moving in space-time.
We don't think about movement that way, but that's really what's happening.
It is?
Sure, take baseball.
Idiot game, Harry said. I hate games.
You know baseball? Ted said to Norman.
Yes, Norman said.
Okay, imagine the batter hits a line drive to the center fielder. The ball goes almost straight out and takes, say, half a second.
Right.
Now, imagine the batter hits a high pop fly to the same center fielder. This time the ball goes way up in the air, and it takes 6 seconds before the center fielder catches it.
Okay.
Now, the paths of the two balls, the line drive and the pop fly, look very different to us. But both these balls moved exactly the same in space-time.
No, Norman said.
Yes, Ted said, and in a way you already know it. Suppose I ask you to hit a high pop fly to the center fielder, but to make it reach the fielder in half a second instead of 6 seconds.
That's impossible, Norman said.
Why? Just hit the pop fly harder.
If I hit it harder, it will go higher and end up taking longer.
Okay, then hit a low line drive that takes 6 seconds to reach center field.
I can't do that either.
Right, Ted said. So what you are telling me is that you can't make the ball do anything you want. There is a fixed relationship governing the path of the ball through space and time.
Sure, because the Earth has gravity.
Yes, Ted said. And we've already agreed that gravity is a curvature of space-time, like the curve of this bowl.
Any baseball on Earth must move along the same curve of space-time as this ball bearing moves along this bowl. Look.
He put the orange back in the bowl.
Here's the Earth.
He put two fingers on opposite sides of the orange.
Here's batter and fielder. Now, roll the ball bearing from one finger to the other, and you'll find you have to accommodate the curve of the bowl. Either you flick the ball lightly and it will roll close to the orange, or you can give it a big flick and it will go way up the side of the bowl before falling down again to the other side. But you can't make this ball bearing do anything you want, because the ball bearing is moving along the curved bowl. And that's what your baseball is really doing. It's moving on curved space-time.
Norman said, I sort of get it. But what does this have to do with time travel? Well, we think the gravitational field of the Earth is strong. It hurts us when we fall down. But in reality, it's very weak. It's almost non-existent. So space-time around the Earth isn't very curved. Space-time is much more curved around the Sun. And in other parts of the universe, it's very curved, producing a sort of roller coaster ride, and all sorts of distortions of time may occur. In fact, if you consider a black hole... He broke off. Yes, Ted? A black hole? Oh, my God, Ted said softly. Harry pushed his glasses up on his nose and said, Ted, for once in your life, you just might be right. They both grabbed for paper, began scribbling. It couldn't be a Schwarzschild hole. No, have to be rotating. Angular momentum would assure that... And you couldn't approach the singularity. No, the tidal forces rip you apart. But if you just dipped below the event horizon... Is it possible? Did they have the nerve? The two fell silent, making calculations, muttering to themselves. What is it about a black hole? Norman said. But they weren't listening to him anymore. The intercom clicked. Barnes said, Attention, this is the captain speaking. I want all hands in the conference room on the double. We're in the conference room, Norman said. On the double, now. We're already there, Hal. That is all, Barnes said, and the intercom clicked off. The conference. I've just been on the scrambler with Admiral Spaulding of SyncCom Pack Honolulu, Barnes said. Apparently Spaulding just learned that I had taken civilians to saturated depths for a project about which he knew nothing. He wasn't happy about it. There was a silence. They all looked at him. He demanded that all the civilians be sent up topside. Good, Norman thought. He had been disappointed by what they had found so far. The prospect of spending another 72 hours in this humid, claustrophobic environment while they investigated an empty space vehicle did not appeal to him. I thought, Ted said, we had direct authorization from the President. We do, Barnes said, but there is the question of the storm. What storm? Harry said. They're reporting 50-knot winds and southeast swells on the surface. It looks like a Pacific cyclone is headed our way and will reach us within 24 hours. There's going to be a storm here? Beth said. Not here, Barnes said. Down here we won't feel anything, but it'll be rough on the surface. All our surface support ships may have to pull out and steam for protected harbors in Tonga. So we'd be left alone down here? For 24 to 48 hours, yes. That wouldn't be a problem. We're entirely self-sufficient. But Spaulding is nervous about pulling surface support when there are civilians below. I want to know your feelings. Do you want to stay down and continue exploring the ship, or leave? Stay, definitely, Ted said. Barnes said, Beth. I came here to investigate unknown life, Beth said. But there isn't any life on that ship. It just isn't what I thought it would be, and hoped it would be. I say we go. Barnes said, Norman. Let's admit the truth, Norman said. We're not really trained for a saturated environment, and we're not really comfortable down here. At least I'm not. And we're not the best people to evaluate this spacecraft. At this point, the Navy'd be much better off with a team of NASA engineers. I say go. Harry? Let's get the hell out, Harry said. Any particular reason? Barnes said. Call it intuition. Ted said, I can't believe you would say that, Harry, just when we have this fabulous new idea about the ship. That's beside the point now, Barnes said crisply. I'll make the arrangements with the surface to pull us out in another 12 hours. Ted said, God damn it. But Norman was looking at Barnes. Barnes wasn't upset. He wants to leave, he thought. He's looking for an excuse to leave, and we're providing his excuse. Meantime, Barnes said, we can make one and perhaps even two more trips to the ship. We'll rest for the next 2 hours and then go back. And that's all for now. I have more I'd like to say. That's all, Ted. The vote's been taken. Get some rest. As they headed toward their bunks, Barnes said, Beth, I'd like a word with you, please.
What about?
Beth, when we go back to the ship, I don't want you pushing every button you come across.
All I did was turn on the lights, Hal.
Yes, but you didn't know that when you...
Sure I did. The button said room lights. It was pretty clear.
As they moved off, they heard Beth say, I'm not one of your little Navy people you can order around, Hal. And then Barnes said something else, and the voices faded.
Damn it,
Ted said. He kicked one of the iron walls. It rang hollowly. They passed into C's cylinder on their way to the bunks.
I can't believe you people want to leave, Ted said. This is such an exciting discovery. How can you walk away from it?
Especially you, Harry. The mathematical possibilities alone. The theory of the black hole. I'll tell you why, Harry said. I want to go because Barnes wants to go.
Barnes doesn't want to go, Ted said.
Why, he put it to a vote.
I know what he did, but Barnes doesn't want to look as if he's made the wrong decision in the eyes of his superiors, or as if he's backing down, so he let us decide. But I'm telling you, Barnes wants to go.
Norman was surprised. The cliché image of mathematicians was that they had their heads in the clouds, were absent-minded, inattentive. But Harry was astute. He didn't miss a thing.
Why would Barnes want to go? Ted said.
I think it's clear, Harry said. Because of the storm on the surface.
The storm isn't here yet, Ted said.
No, Harry said. And when it comes, we don't know how long it will last.
Barnes said 24 to 48 hours.
Neither Barnes nor anyone else can predict how long the storm will last, Harry said. What if it lasts 5 days?
We can hold out that long. We have air and supplies for 5 days.
What are you so worried about? I'm not worried, Harry said, but I think Barnes is worried.
Nothing will go wrong, for Christ's sake, Ted said. I think we should stay.
And then there was a squishing sound. They looked down at the all-weather carpeting at their feet. The carpet was dark, soaked.
What's that?
I'd say it was water, Harry said.
Salt water?
Ted said, bending over, touching the damp spot. He licked his finger.
Doesn't taste salty.
From above them, a voice said, That's because it's urine. Looking up, they saw Teeny Fletcher standing on a platform among a network of pipes near the curved top of the cylinder. Everything's under control, gentlemen. Just a small leak in the liquid waste disposal pipe that goes to the H2O recycler.
Liquid waste?
Ted was shaking his head. Just a small leak, Fletcher said. No problem, sir. She sprayed one of the pipes with white foam from a spray canister. The foam sputtered and hardened on the pipe. We just urethane the suckers when we get them. Makes a perfect seal.
How often do you get these leaks? Harry said.
Liquid waste? Ted said again. Hard to say, Dr. Adams, but don't worry, really.
I feel sick, Ted said.
Harry slapped him on the back. Come on, it won't kill you. Let's get some sleep.
I think I'm going to throw up.
They went into the sleeping chamber. Ted immediately ran off to the showers. They heard him coughing and gagging. Poor Ted, Harry said, shaking his head. Norman said, What's all this business about a black hole, anyway? A black hole, Harry said, is a dead, compressed star. Basically, a star is like a big beach ball inflated by the atomic explosions occurring inside it. When a star gets old and runs out of nuclear fuel, the ball collapses to a much smaller size. If it collapses enough, it becomes so dense and it has so much gravity that it keeps on collapsing, squeezing down on itself until it is very dense and very small, only a few miles in diameter. Then it's a black hole. Nothing else in the universe is as dense as a black hole.
So they're black because they're dead?
Nope, they're black because they trap all the light. Black holes have so much gravity they pull everything into them, like vacuum cleaners. All the surrounding interstellar gas and dust, and even light itself, they just suck it right up.
They suck up light? Norman said.
He found it hard to think of that.
Yes.
So, what were you two so excited about with your calculations?
Oh, it's a long story, and it's just speculation, Harry yawned.
It probably won't amount to anything anyway. Talk about it later?
Sure, Norman said. Harry rolled over, went to sleep. Ted was still in the showers, hacking and sputtering. Norman went back to D-Cell to Tina's console. Did Harry find you all right? He said. I know he wanted to see you.
Yes, sir, and I have the information he requested now.
Why? Did you want to make out your will, too?
Norman frowned.
Dr. Adams said he didn't have a will and he wanted to make one. He seemed to feel it was quite urgent. Anyway, I checked with the surface, and you can't do it. It's some legal problem about it being in your own handwriting. You can't transmit your will over electronic lines.
Yeah, I see.
I'm sorry, Dr. Johnson. Should I tell the others as well?
No, Norman said. Don't bother the others. We'll be going to the surface soon, right after we have one last look at the ship.
The Large Glass. This time they split up inside the spaceship. Barnes, Ted, and Edmonds continued forward in the vast cargo bays to search the parts of the ship that were still unexplored. Norman, Beth, and Harry stayed in what they now called the flight deck, looking for the flight recorder. Ted's parting words were, "It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done." Then he set off with Barnes. Edmonds left them a small video monitor so they could see the progress of the other team in the forward section of the ship. And they could hear. Ted chattered continuously to Barnes, giving his views about structural features of the ship. The design of the big cargo bays reminded Ted of the stonework of the ancient Mycenaeans in Greece, particularly the Lion Gate ramp at Mycenae.
"Ted has more irrelevant facts at his fingertips than any man I know," Harry said. "Can we turn the volume down?"
Yawning, Norman turned the monitor down. He was tired. The bunks in DH-8 were damp, the electric blankets heavy and clinging. Sleep had been almost impossible. And then Beth had come storming in after her talk with Barnes. She was still angry now.
"Goddamn Barnes," she said. "Where does he get off?"
"He's doing the best he can, like everyone else," Norman said.
She spun. "You know, Norman, sometimes you're too psychological and understanding. The man is an idiot, a complete idiot."
"Let's just find the flight recorder, shall we?" Harry said. "That's the important thing now." Harry was following the umbilicus cable that ran out the back of the mannequin into the floor. He was lifting up floor panels, tracing the wires aft.
"I'm sorry," Beth said.
"But he wouldn't speak like that to a man. Certainly not to Ted. Ted's hogging the whole show, and I don't see why he should be allowed to."
"What does Ted have to do with—" Norman began.
"The man is a parasite, that's what he is. He takes the ideas of others and promotes them as his own. Even the way he quotes famous sayings, it's outrageous."
"You feel he takes other people's ideas?" Norman said.
"Listen, back on the surface, I mentioned to Ted that we ought to have some words ready when we open this thing. And the next thing I know, Ted's making up quotes and positioning himself in front of the camera."
"Well..." "Well, what, Norman? Don't well me, for Christ's sake. It was my idea, and he took it without so much as a thank you."
"Did you say anything to him about it?" Norman said.
"No, I did not say anything to him about it. I'm sure he wouldn't remember if I did. He'd go, 'Did you say that, Beth? I suppose you might have mentioned something like that, yes.'"
"I still think you should talk to him."
"Norman, you're not listening to me."
"If you talked to him, at least you wouldn't be so angry about it now."
"Shrink talk," she said, shaking her head.
"Look, Ted does whatever he wants on this expedition. He makes his stupid speeches, whatever he wants. But I go through the door first, and Barnes gives me hell. Why shouldn't I go first? What's wrong with a woman being the first for once in the history of science?"
"Beth, and then I had the gall to turn on the lights. You know what Barnes said about that? He said I might have started a short circuit and put us all in jeopardy. He said I didn't know what I was doing. He said I was impulsive."
"Jesus, impulsive. Stone Age military cretin."
"Turn the volume back up," Harry said. "I'd rather hear Ted."
"Come on, guys."
"We're all under a lot of pressure, Beth," Norman said. "It's going to affect everybody in different ways."
She glared at Norman.
"You're saying Barnes was right?"
"I'm saying we're all under pressure, including him, including you."
Jesus, you men always stick together.
Do you know why I'm still an assistant professor and not tenured?
Your pleasant, easygoing personality, Harry said.
I can do without this. I really can.
Beth, Harry said,
you see the way these cables are going? They're running toward that bulkhead there.